Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. That was a strange skip there. Well, today we are talking about the increasing problem of homelessness. Homeless people, especially those with mental illnesses, have become a visible and almost permanent part of our urban social landscape. There's a new report out by UC Berkeley called California's New Vagrancy Laws, the growing enactment and enforcement of anti-homeless laws in the Golden State. And it found that one in five homeless people in the state, United States, reside in California. 136,000 people in California are homeless, but advocates say that number is much higher than official estimates, and cities are responding by criminalizing the homeless population. UC Berkeley researchers found over 500 restrictions in California municipalities, nearly nine laws per city. From 2007 to 2013, here in San Francisco, the city issued over 3,000 citations per year for sleeping, camping, standing, sitting, resting, and panhandling in public. In Sacramento, citations for violating an anti-camping code within city limits rose from fewer than 50 in 2010 to nearly 1,200 2 years later in 2012. The UC Berkeley report says a state-level solution is needed to end those policies. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about some of those solutions. More importantly, what are the long-term solutions to homelessness? You may have heard recently about the Housing First program. It's receiving national attention. It's happening in Utah, and we'll be talking to someone in Utah a little later in the show. Is something like that possible in California, where you basically give homeless people homes? The question is, where does the funding come from? Joining us to talk about this is Dr. Robert Okin. He served as chief of psychiatry at San Francisco General Hospital for 17 years. Dr. Okin spent 2 years photographing and talking to San Francisco's homeless population, many with mental illnesses. They tell their own stories in a book with photographs called Silent Voices, People with Mental Disorders on the Street. And Bob joins me here in studio. Hi, Bob. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
We're also joined by Paul Bowden, Executive Director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project. That's an organization that works to expose and eliminate the root causes of the civil and human rights abuses of people experiencing poverty and homelessness. Paul is former director of San Francisco's Coalition on Homelessness and author of the new book, House Keys, Not Handcuffs, Homeless Organizing, Art, and Politics in San Francisco. And Paul will be speaking next Tuesday at 7:30 at the Booksmith in San Francisco, 1644 Haight Street. And Paul also joins us in studio. Hey, Paul, thanks for coming in.
Hey, Rose, thanks for having me.
So it's great to see you both. I want to start off by just talking about numbers. Do you think that this problem is growing? Because I feel like I'm seeing a lot more homeless people in San Francisco. I mean, it's not uncommon to see about 15 to 20 people in the Powell Street BART station at night, for example. Now, the official numbers, 136,000 people in California. And then at the federal level, the official number is 700,000. Paul, you say those numbers are very, very low.
Yeah, and I think that it's really an attempt to try to downplay the severity of the problem by the federal government. They invested a lot of money in homeless management information systems, point-in-time headcounts, creating all of these databases. They're going to spend $7 million next year just studying homeless people. You know, and it's all about a pretense of doing something. When we had the affordable housing funding in the mid-70s and before that, we didn't have all of this quote-unquote homeless problem. We eliminate the affordable housing funding and homelessness continues to grow. That's cause and effect, and it's common sense, and it's logic. But 32 years later, we're debating whether it's 1.2 million kids versus 700,000 homeless people. And that's a manifestation of government that doesn't want to address a problem studies a problem and forms task forces and has conferences. And we have 14 national homeless coalitions. And, you know, we're doing everything but what created the problem? We cut affordable housing funding. So let's fix it.
Bob, how do you see it? What are your thoughts on the official numbers from the U.S. government and what we're actually facing on the ground? I mean, you spent 2 years interviewing people, homeless people in San Francisco with mental illnesses.
Well, it's hard to believe those numbers. And when you walk through almost any city, there's so many people on the streets. It's just really hard to imagine that those figures are doing anything but hiding the full extent of the problem.
So what do you think is the real problem? And how would we get the real problem out there? Because the Huffington Post had an interesting piece earlier this month about President Obama's chief of staff, Dennis McDonough, who ventured out onto San Francisco streets with San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee and Trent Rohr, director of the city's Human Services Agency, to... well, count homeless people, basically.
Well, it's called the point-in-time headcount.
Right.
And I think the irony above all ironies is it's conducted every other year on January 25th. That's the night that the federal government has deemed the night that people across the country, so you're in Chicago, you're in Bozeman, Montana, you're in some pretty freaking cold places, climates, and January 25th, people are supposed to go out and count heads. And then that derives, and then the number of people in HUD-funded shelters, that derives your homeless statistics. I mean, in the mid-'80s through the 90s, they used to do what was called a gaps analysis, which was looking at the system and looking at supply and demand. When you have 20,000 people on your waiting list for public housing, you got a housing problem. But what do? They cut the waiting list and they stop collecting names. When you go for mental health services and you're turned away because they're full, they don't even document turnaways. From healthcare for the homeless programs, from homeless services, from shelters, they don't document the number of people that get turned away every day. So you have no any kind of information that tells you what is the supply and what is the demand for that service. And if we did, healthcare would be a much higher priority. If we did, residential treatment wouldn't be a thing of the past. And if we did, we would restore the funding to affordable housing and forget all these chronic homeless and HUD, VASH, you know, VA. VA used to build housing and supply healthcare. Now they're doing wraparound case management services and using HUD vouchers. You know, our public housing stock, we're going to start using Section 8 vouchers to make it affordable for people to be able to live and for nonprofits to manage public housing. Why aren't we just increasing the public housing budget? Why are we doing this robbing Peter to pay Paul and then wondering why the problem keeps getting worse?
Hmm. What would you add to that, Bob? Because when we read stories about homelessness, these issues are really... in the articles. We don't talk about the systemic problems
unless it's
here.
The street sheet.
Okay, unless it's the street sheet, right, the paper that's written by homeless people. And it just had a big anniversary recently.
Sure did.
What are your thoughts on that? Because homeless advocates in San Francisco say it was so rare, for example, to see an older homeless woman on the streets in San Francisco in the 70s and the 80s, and now it's common. So how do you explain how we got here?
Well, I think the primary reason that we have so many homeless people on the street is because we cut the housing budget. I mean, I think it's fairly straightforward. The solutions are a little more complicated, but they have to start with housing. Housing is the most expensive solution, though much cheaper than homelessness, I might say. But it's the most expensive solution, and it's the most complex to solve. So government tends to look away from it.
And I would also add to that, it HUD didn't, and the federal government did not stop funding housing. You know, at the same period of time that the housing budget was cut, the homeowners mortgage interest deduction program went from the equivalent of around $44 billion in 2004 constant dollars to now it's $144 billion a year. And if I owe you $50 and I tell you to keep it, I just gave you $50. So, and if you ask me for $50 and I give you $50, they're the same thing, whether it's a housing subsidy paid out or whether it's a housing subsidy through a tax credit not collected. So we still fund housing. We fund housing at the highest levels we've ever funded housing. It's the neoliberal economics that guides the priority of the type of housing we're willing to fund. And so when we talk about we give the homeless homes, we're not giving them anything. We're subsidizing their housing, just like we subsidize the housing of homeowners across the country.
I think that's a very important point. The fact that mortgage interest is deductible against taxes is a clear subsidy to people who own homes. So the idea that we shouldn't spend the money that it requires to help homeless people is just completely unfair. It's just that it's a hidden the mortgage subsidy tends to be a hidden subsidy in this debate.
So, Paul, you talk about affordable housing funding and how that's been slashed over the years. What would it look like if some of that funding was restored?
It would look like it looked in 1980 and 1979 and 1981 when we didn't have homeless programs across the country. So it would look like it looked in the past. It would look like maybe you would have detox facilities. Certainly you would have residential treatment programs. The USDA funds rural housing development. They used to build over 30,000 units of affordable housing a year. They haven't built any in the last 3 years. So you would see the VA and the housing programs of the VA, you would see a robust local economy because people would be housed, people would be able to get work. The development of housing is jobs. You know, so you would see a much more robust local economies, and you would see nobody that sleeping on the streets without an alternative to what the to what was happening.
I would say that mostly I agree with Paul, but I think there are some differences. Deinstitutionalization of the mental hospitals has taken place since then. There's a much larger prison population, and unfortunately the way we deal with prisoners when we release them is we just release them with almost nothing in their pocket. So we're constantly creating a potentially homeless population. Also, we've had several wars since the early 70s, anyway, that creates veterans that are vulnerable to homelessness. So and also there's been a loss of blue-collar jobs across the United States. So I think there are social forces that have increased the vulnerable population. And in the when gentrification takes place of the housing stock, the most vulnerable of the population fall out of the system and become homeless. I think we have a much greater vulnerable population today than we did then.
That is Dr. Robert Okun. He served as chief of psychiatry at San Francisco General for 17 years. He spent 2 years photographing and talking to San Francisco's homeless population, many with mental illnesses, and they tell their own stories in a book with photos called Silent Voices, People with Mental Disorders on the Street. Paul Bowden is executive director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project. That's an organization that works to eliminate the root causes of the issues we're talking about today. Paul is former director of San Francisco's Coalition on Homelessness and author of House Keys Not Handcuffs, Homeless Organizing, Art, and Politics in San Francisco. Paul will be speaking next Tuesday, March 10th at the Booksmith, 730 1644 Haight Street in San Francisco. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. What does it look like in your area? What changes are you seeing with the homeless population? What are your thoughts on long-term solutions? And if you've heard about the Housing First program, specifically the one in Utah, it's getting national attention. What questions do you have about that? We'll be joined by someone from Utah in about 10 or so minutes. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you work with the homeless population, what are your thoughts? If you're a city official, what are your thoughts on this issue? You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Andrea in Santa Cruz. Hi, Andrea. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. I think you got my message last week, and I really need to meet with you and talk with you. There's some things that are going on, and I really can't say, you know, at public level on the radio, but it's getting really bad here in Santa Cruz, you know, and things are really taking a turn for the worse for me, and, you know, it's gotten really cold here. It's been like 30-something degrees out, and it's getting to that time of year where my manager starts flipping out. You know, she wants $1,200 for the rent, you know, instead of $850 because it's tourist season now. So I get out there every day. I go out here at night, and I sweep the whole parking lot. I mean, I sweep everything, the gutters, everything, and people will come up and ask me, wow, you do a really good job. You get paid for this? Like, no. but I just want to do what I can do to keep my manager off my back, you know? Mm-hmm. But I have a friend, my friend Cece, she's on the street, and she's schizophrenic, and it's just, it's breaking my heart, man. You know, her and I went through Navy boot camp together a long time ago.
Hey, Andrea, can you talk about what changes you are seeing in Santa Cruz?
Well, for the worst, it's just gotten worse. I mean, there's three times many people go to the soup kitchen. We do have, like, a lot of food distribution set in Santa Cruz, but these places are all spread out. They're hard to get to. You know, I don't have good mobility. You know, a lot of people that go to the methadone clinic now are homeless, and they're camping out, like, right up there in the Emmeline complex, so they're close to the clinic so they can dose every day. I go to the methadone clinic every day. I have to go pretty soon, and it's really hard, you know, and see people come up with shopping carts and sleeping bags, and it's just really hard. Here I am, 2 years and 3 months later, still in this motel because the advocates here are supposed to be finding me a place to live, and it hasn't happened yet, and it's really discouraging, but there's some other things that I'd like to talk to you about in private, so I hope to talk with you soon, okay?
Okay, well, thank you, Andrea. Thanks for calling. So Andrea lives in a motel, and she says her rent fluctuates, and this is the case with a lot of people who live in motels, going from $850 to $1,200 because it's tourist season. What about services? What changes are you seeing? I was just talking to some homeless people on Market Street last week, and a number of people said when they travel across the country, word on the street is that in the Bay Area, you will actually get services, and that's why so many people come to the Bay Area. Is that what you hear, and is that true? Paul?
I've heard that about cities in general. I've not heard it about San Francisco in particular. So I'm not totally, you know, different people say different things. And so if we go off of the word of one person or two people that we talk to on the street, you know, I've not experienced. And when the coalition and others did the outreach and documented the, you know, way more people than they thought actually were from here. So, you know, mm-hmm. I think everywhere you go, the homeless people are from somewhere else. So there must be like some foreign land where homeless people are created and then we just drop in. Or, you know, in the 80s, our DNA changed and we decided it's really cool to sleep outside. That's not been my experience, but I hear that quite a bit. And I didn't mean to disagree with Bob before. I mean, the race and class issues that are behind what's going on, the 60s and redevelopment agency tearing down poor neighborhoods, you know, that isn't seen as connected to the homeless problem. But in fact, it's that type of policy and that type of belief system that gentrification means displacing poor people from the communities that they live, that somehow the only way to improve the living conditions is to get rid of poor and disabled people from communities in order for them to be clean or whiter or brighter communities. And I agree those issues would still be there. The shelter system and the chronic homeless programs and the point-in-time headcounts and the homeless management information systems, those systems don't need to be here, and they wouldn't be here anymore if we had the housing funding. But sure as hell, race and class is going to be an issue until we really address that, which is the Right to Rest Act is an attempt to try and address those issues.
Well, thank you again, Andrea. That's Paul Bowden, Executive Director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project, and Dr. Robert Okin served as Chief of Psychiatry at San Francisco General for 17 years. And now I would like to welcome Tamara Kohler to the show. Tamara is Director of the Utah State Community Services Office, and Utah has been receiving national attention for its Housing First program. Hi, Tamara. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate an opportunity to speak with you.
Well, we appreciate you coming on to share information about the Housing First program. So according to reports, the first pilot program placed 17 people in homes scattered around Salt Lake City, and after 22 months, not one of them was back on the streets. In the years since, the number of Utah's chronically homeless has fallen by 74%. Is that accurate?
That's accurate.
Wow. That's a huge number.
It is quite a large number. I think what we learned is that you can effectively house your most vulnerable population and be able to retain their housing if you use a Housing First model and be able to wrap around those supportive services.
So when we were talking about this before the show, both of our guests said, where is this money coming from? How are you funding this?
I think that's always an interesting question. We get that quite often. And I think that it's important that, yes, you understand the funding, but you also need to understand you've got to have a coordinated and collaborative approach. A significant amount of the funding comes through HUD, through your continuum of care. And what we did is we prioritized that housing dollars to be able to house the most vulnerable. By HUD's definition, the chronic, using up a lot of our services, with disabling conditions, living in places not meant for habitation or in our shelters. And what we really did is a targeted focus on that population, and we drove home the importance of being able to house them without very limited barriers. They didn't have to be clean and sober. They didn't have to be through a treatment program, because we found they were also our most expensive users of our system. And what we did over time, and starting by just let's put these 17 out in a pilot and let's see how they do, while we invested housing dollars, tax credits, state-funded dollars, HUD subsidies, to be able to do not only project-based but scattered site models, so that that population, some thrive better in a communal type of work, a communal type of housing, some do better in a scattered site in their own apartments. Mm-hmm. And what we did is realized we needed a little bit of all to be able to solve the problem, and we stayed focused on the objective. We figured our system could improve, our knowledge would improve, but our partners came to the table to really make this happen. And it is a targeted and focused approach with the funding resources that most communities already have. We didn't get significant foundation funding. We didn't get significant other funding from our state. We took the funding we had and targeted it on this population.
I want to ask our guests to ask you questions, Tamara. But first of all, where did this idea come from?
Well, the Housing First model, the state of Utah started looking at it when we were encouraged to create a 10-year plan to end chronic homelessness in about 2003. We had the opportunity to look at Samson Barris's model out of New York, and we found at first we were a little skeptical, but when we went out and we looked at it, and this Housing First idea that you put people into housing before you require them to make life changes, it's near impossible to make life changes when you're on the street. But placed into housing, you're able to then start putting back together a smart, workable plan for each individual. And so we looked at Samson Barris's model, felt like it was worth our time to pilot it with the 17 that you spoke of, and then start gearing our resources around actually building and using some existing capacity to start targeting that population and housing them appropriately.
It's an amazing program. We're going to take a quick break, but I'd love to get our guests to ask you a question when we come back. We are talking today about solutions to homelessness, and we're joined by Tamara Kohler, director of the Utah State Community Services Office. You may have read about the Housing First program in Utah. It's getting national attention. The first pilot program placed 17 people in homes scattered around Salt Lake City. After 22 months, not one of them was back on the streets. In the years since, the number of Utah's chronically homeless population has fallen by 74%. So we will ask Tamara more questions after the break about whether or not families are included, and exactly, we'll ask her for some personal stories. We're also joined today by Dr. Robert Okun, served as chief of psychiatry at San Francisco General for 17 years, and he's author of the book Silent Voices, People with Mental Disorders on the Street. It's an amazing book full of photos of people that Bob spent, he spoke to, interviewed people on the streets of San Francisco for 2 years. And Paul Bowden is executive director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project and author of House Keys, Not Handcuffs, Homeless Organizing, Art, and Politics in San Francisco. What are your thoughts on this? What are the long-term solutions to homelessness? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio, a program that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation. The toll-free number is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-TALK. Or you can post your question or comment on the website, yourcallradio.org. There's an email address as well, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC, and following that at noon today, it's Backstory.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will open the lines to take your thoughts about our show, what you like about the show, what we can do better. Every year, we open the lines to hear from you. What are your thoughts about solutions? What shows stand out for you? And what would you add to our editorial mix? That's tomorrow. And if you have a guest idea or a show idea, you can, well, call us tomorrow, or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about solutions to homelessness. We'd love to hear from you. What does this issue look like in your area? Are you seeing the number of homeless people growing? What are long-term solutions? If you work in this with homeless people, we'd love to hear from you. If you're a city official, how are you tackling this? What questions do you have about Housing First programs? Today, we're joined by Tamara Kohler, director of the Utah State Community Services Office. Dr. Robert Okun served as chief of psychiatry at SF General for 17 years. He's author of Silent Voices, People with Mental Disorders on the Street. Paul Bowden is executive director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project and author of House Keys, Not Handcuffs. Paul will be speaking next Tuesday night, March 10th at 7:30 at the Booksmith, 1644 Haight Street. And Tamara, how many people have gone through the program? How many people in Utah have been housed so far?
You know, it varies because we do have people we've placed into housing, and they're able to move on to maybe a different type of housing, Section 8. They reunify with family and move on. We have over 900 permanent supportive housing units. And to put that in context, last year's point in time, we haven't put out this year's, but last year's point in time, our homeless numbers for the state of Utah were just over 13,620. So when you look at 900 permanent supportive housing units, that obviously is not enough to house that homeless population. But we have found about 80% of those that come into our shelter or touched by our outreach, our unsheltered population, within 60 days within shelter, they have moved on and been able to move out of our system without any housing assistance. So when you think of a homeless system, delivery of services, we are able to use very small amount of resources for those that really need more long-term solutions.
Tamara, Dr. Robert Okun served as chief of psychiatry at San Francisco General. He worked with the mentally ill population for 17 years, and he spent 2 years on the streets of San Francisco interviewing people. Dr. Okun, do you have any questions for Tamara about this program?
Yeah, I would just I'd like her to just review the statistics that she gave. How many homeless, chronically homeless people were there in Utah when the program started, and how many chronically homeless people are there now?
So when we originally started collecting data in 2005, we counted 1,932 chronic homeless individuals on that one night. And then when we counted again in 2014, and we do it annually every year, both sheltered and unsheltered, we had 539. And that's statewide. So I think that when you have the conversation of most of them in your metro areas, that is very true, but we do have them statewide as well.
Paul, what about you? Do you have questions? Paul Bowden is executive director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project and works very closely with the homeless population here in San Francisco.
Well, I guess my comment, and get asked about Housing First a lot, and I think that for those of us that have been doing this for 30 years, I mean, nothing ends homelessness like a home. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't think that's a new mantra. The concern that I have is it's not funded. It's reallocating funding from other programs, low-income housing tax credits, I noticed were mentioned, or the continuum of care funding through the McKinney-Vento programs. And I just worry because with the redefining of family homelessness in order to better meet the needs of the most severely chronic, which, you know, is a little troublesome to me that you're chronic homeless versus homeless. I don't quite get the distinction. But was funding shifted from family programs to this program? Is that how it was implemented for these 900 units? I read about the HUD VA outreach with some special vouchers. But other than that, I haven't seen any new allocation of resources to implement Housing First. And I think we all should welcome that because Housing First makes perfect sense.
I think that is a very good question to ask. Because when we started this back in 2005, the amount of HUD funding in relation to the numbers was greater than what we currently have now. VASH vouchers was new funding. It didn't take away from any of our existing
right.
Section 8s. So VASH voucher is a Section 8 for a veteran. And so that new interjection of funding through the VA with HUD housing has really allowed us to make substantial impact in our chronic veterans and our veterans across the nation. When we started looking at this in 2005, we didn't just turn off all of our funding for all of the other homeless populations and only focus on chronic. What we found is the chronic were using up to 50% of our resources. So by targeting housing for this population, it created the capacity. It was costing us on average about $20,000 for all of their various uses of other emergency systems, the police, those kind of resources, and it really was costing us for individuals about $8,000 to $10,000 with supportive services. So there was a cost savings that was there and is well documented. It also created capacity in our shelters. These were long-term users in our shelter. By being able to get them housed, we're actually able to open up capacity, and we have not for years now turned anyone away from shelter in the state of Utah. So it created an ability for us to get them in the system and be able to assess what their needs were and be able to move them through that system to more appropriate resources before they have the long-term stays in a homeless system that creates the barriers and the chronic pieces and the interaction with police and the interaction with emergency services. So it's a system approach. I don't think that, and we allocate not only state funds but federal funds through my office, and yes, we do prioritize that, but so has HUD in the continuum of care, but we still have a significant amount of funding for families, and in fact, we've used TANF dollars to really work with families since the recession and have really put an emphasis on there. So I think it is absolutely, we are resource short, but we can target those and use them more effectively. And I don't believe that we have shortchanged other pieces of the homeless population. What we have actually done is open up capacity and be able to take those savings and put them back into the system to serve those that don't need that level of support. They don't need the long-term housing subsidy. But it does require a system. We need more affordable housing. We have too many families that are homeless. We have too many individuals that can't afford. I think I heard on your call someone staying in the motels and the challenges in rent.
Right.
As a country, we need more really, really low affordable housing if we want to end homelessness overall.
I think that's Bob. Really important to underscore, because the way the Utah model has been advertised, not necessarily by Utah itself, but the way it's been discussed in the press, it makes it sound as though the country can really do with the amount of funds that are currently being allocated for housing, and it can't. You know, so housing first is absolutely the right policy, but without an increase in federal funds, other homeless people are going to be shortchanged. So it's very important, for people in Utah to make the point that our guest made, that it is going to require much more funding to deal with the homeless population in this country.
Because, Bob, you have said when you were on the show last time around that city-by-city solutions are not the answer. It has
right.
to come from the federal government.
Yes.
So what are your thoughts on what could happen in California? Do you think that we could have a Housing First program in California?
I think we could have a Housing First program, and I think it would definitely help. But without additional federal resources, I think it's very hard for individual cities or individual states to solve the problem, even if their policy changes. The policy should change, but that shouldn't cover up the fact that at the federal level, much more funds need to be allocated for housing.
Dr. Robert Okun served as chief of psychiatry at SF General for 17 years. He's author of Silent Voices, People with Mental Disorders on the Street. Paul Bowden is executive director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project and author of House Keys, Not Handcuffs. He'll be speaking next Tuesday night, March 10th, 7:30 at the Booksmith, 1644 Haight Street. And Tamara Kohler is director of the Utah State Community Services Office. Since they implemented the Housing First program, the number of Utah's chronically homeless has fallen by 74%. Tamara, I know we have to let you go soon, but can you just tell us a few stories about some of the people that have been housed and have not gone back onto the streets?
You know, we put on an annual homeless summit each year, and I had the opportunity of bringing in someone who has gone through this system, has been chronically homeless with the barriers that exist, whether it's persistent mental illness, various reduced capacity, physical disabilities, substance abuse issues that have become so disabling. And we have had the opportunity to have some of the most compelling stories presented at that summit. And I think the underlying story that we get, and we had Joseph Hardy last year. This is a gentleman who grew up homeless most of his childhood, living in the back of his car, moving around with his family in various systems that were highly at risk, exposed to a number of different things, and then at a very young age started to have challenges with substance abuse and mental health issues, not really sure which came first, and then also having a period of time that he was incarcerated due to some of those challenges with substance abuse. And when he was able to connect with our outreach workers who could assess him and identify the level of homelessness he was experiencing, the level of mental health issues that were there and needed to be addressed, and working with him to address what did we need to do to end his homelessness, something that he had spent his lifetime experiencing from a very young child. And when he came and spoke, it is very unfiltered, and it is very humbling to understand that he first needed to be recognized as an individual. We sought him out and had those kind of tough conversations, offered him housing, of which he accepted, without a lot of preconditions, and then coming into housing and the difference it makes in an individual's life to have a door that locks, to actually have a fridge to put food in, to actually be able to unpack a backpack and put those clothes somewhere and know that they're safe and they're cared for. The level of safety that it creates, it's hard for them sometimes to adjust to. And he was very appreciative of those case managers, those outreach workers, those that went out early in the morning and found him and offered him clean socks and water and also encouraged him to come in out of the cold into housing. And he is a great advocate now for change, not only in the homeless system but also in our correctional system. These individuals have something to give back to us as a society. They have an opportunity to teach us what we need to know, and we need to listen, and we need to make these achievable for them with very low barriers. There is an opportunity to make an impact in people's lives. We truly are saving lives by housing individuals. One of your guests had said, how do you end homelessness? You house them. And that is such a critical piece. How do we save lives in a homeless population? It is by being able to house them, assess them appropriately, connect them. How important it was to get him with the right level of case management to be able to get him healthy and well and on a road to recovery is just a awe-inspiring thing to watch.
Paul, sorry, Tamara. Paul, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, no, I mean, housing is cool. Housing rocks. You know, it reminds me of under the Clinton administration, they spent $3 million doing a five-year study of homeless families that got a Section 8 unit and moved into the unit and were surprised to find out that 5 years later, 98% of them were still in those units. Mm-hmm. It's like, of course they were still in those units. You know, just because we come from the street doesn't mean we're stupid. Housing is really cool, and it should be a right. It should be something that we all have a right to as human beings. And of course it improves your quality of life. Of course you think better, you feel better. Your teeth, you can actually maybe keep some of your teeth. You know, the hardest part being out in the street, man, I could get a lawyer, you know, from a lot of people, but getting a dentist was a hell of a lot harder. And now my teeth are all fake. You know, it's like, yes, your life is going to change, but the whole community is going to be uplifted by it. You know, and if we think it's such a value for homeowners that we invest $144 billion a year, we shouldn't have to be rearranging chairs on the deck of the Titanic to meet the needs of people, and because we now identify them as the chronically homeless. You know, it should be something that it really is housing first. You know, and then ask questions. That was my favorite part of running a hotel for mentally ill homeless people was, in them days, I could move you into the unit and then ask you questions about what kind of help you needed, what kind of DSM-3 diagnosis you had, or whatever it was that was going on. Because I knew that asking you that before you got the unit, you were going to tell me what you thought I needed to know in order to get that unit. That's how desperate people are for housing when it's made available to them and when they're treated like human beings. And I all congrats to Utah, and I hope they keep pushing it, and I hope they keep making the point that coupled with this is treatment. Coupled with this is treating people like human beings. And coupled with this is investing in affordable housing for everybody.
Tamara, before we let you go, we have a caller with a question. Let's go to Buck in San Francisco. Hi, Buck.
Hi. Love your show. Thank you. Great guest.
Thank you.
So San Francisco's programs are praised, and much of that praise is worthy. But what bothers me about our town and our current mayor, he doesn't believe in strong rent control, doesn't believe in keeping an existing rental housing. He believes in building more affordable housing. It costs about $250,000 in subsidy for every affordable housing unit produced in this town, and the mayor is just not making it available. There was a meeting about the Balboa Reservoir site across from City College. Instead of saying, wow, hundreds of affordable units for families, for seniors, for homeless people, built by a nonprofit, his position was, well, we're going to have market-rate housing there, and we'll have some affordable units on site. So I guess if folks, this is more a comment than a question, but if your esteemed panel has any comments on what the city could be doing to build more affordable housing, I think the mayor needs to pony up the money that it takes and support strong rent control so landlords have less of an incentive to push people out of the housing they're in.
All right, thank you. Tamara, before we let you go, how did you deal with this? I mean, I know that Salt Lake City rents are nowhere near San Francisco's rents, where it's, you know, now $3,500 for a one-bedroom. But where did the housing come from?
You know, I was listening thinking it tends to be the same message no matter where you go.
Yeah.
The rents that we need to be affordable, especially in our cities, because that's where the services many times are at and that's where the transportation is, that it is a challenge. We had great partnerships with our housing authorities. We had great partnerships with state funding, and we literally carved it out to make it work. We converted an old hotel into affordable housing units with subsidies in it for our homeless and our chronically homeless. It takes a collaborative approach, and you do need favorable conditions in your city with your zoning. It takes all of that. There's no magic bullet in this. It takes all of that. It takes good, strong advocates. You need champions that'll talk about this night and day, and you've got to line all of those pieces up.
Well, Tamara, thank you for joining us and sharing stories about what's happening in Utah. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Tamara Kohler is director of the Utah State Community Services Office. You can read about their Housing First program at yourcallradio.org. Since they implemented this program, the number of Utah's chronically homeless has fallen by 74%. As Paul Bowden says, it's pretty obvious. If you house someone, most people stay in the house and things start to improve. Paul Bowden is executive director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project, author of House Keys, Not Handcuffs. He'll be speaking next Tuesday at the Booksmith, 7:30, March 10th, 1644 Haight Street. Dr. Robert Okin is author of Silent Voices, People with Mental Disorders on the Streets. He spent 2 years photographing and talking to people on the street and 17 years as chief of psychiatry at SF General, treating people on the streets. Bob, okay, let's say we got more money from the federal government. Let's say they diverted money from the weapons programs, for example, or changed the tax system, closed tax loopholes. We talked about this last show. And we were able to have a Housing First program in a place like San Francisco or the Bay Area. How would it be implemented? How would it work in a place where rents are so incredibly high?
Well, we'd have to use both city land and private land to create additional housing units. It starts with the value, adopting the value that people have a right to housing, that it's a human right, and that it's a disgrace for a country that's the richest country in the world to have so many homeless people. So you have to start out with that as a value, and everything else has got to be organized around that value. So I think what's necessary is a combination of different kinds of housing. People are different, and some people will not accept traditional supportive housing. They want something else. So there needs to be a spectrum of housing. The city has land, and it could be used to create housing for this population. But unless, and I stress this again, unless a national solution is adopted, people will simply move from one city to another city based on primarily three things, I think. One, the weather. Secondly, the amount of services and housing. People will be drawn in like a magnet to those cities, and the city will therefore never be able to keep up with the demand, and there will be discouragement among the public who will get tired of funding housing. And thirdly, there's a need for – the reason that there's a need for a national solution is that people are going to be moving from jails out of the jails as the jail system contracts, as it should, and a whole new population of potentially homeless people will be being released. So the country has got to deal with that population. Otherwise, we'll have the same problem from the deinstitutionalization of the jail system mm-hmm. that we had in as a result of deinstitutionalizing the mental health system.
We have about 5 minutes left. Where does this go from here? I mean, what is realistic, Paul?
Well, I would like to at least get in a few words about the criminalization aspect.
Yes,
And about the Right to Rest Act, which was introduced by State Senator Carol Liu just last week. It's Senate Bill 608. And we also have a bill that's been introduced in Oregon by State Senator Chip Shields, and we have a bill that with commitments to introduce it in Colorado. It's the same bill in all three states because we're the ALEC of the Poor People's Movement. And it's to stop the criminalization of sitting, standing, eating, sleeping in a legally parked vehicle. Kudos to the people down in Pacifica, the community members that rally together to stop the police chief's attempt to criminalize sleeping in a vehicle 24/7 down there, because they saw that this was a human rights issue. And I think, you know, when you look at anti-Okie laws, when you look at sundown towns, when you look at Jim Crow, the criminalization of mentally ill people under what the courts call nuisance crimes, meaning being in public space and being mentally ill, if local governments have abused their authority to pass these laws, and the laws that there's a giant uptick in the passing of laws against sitting, eating, laying down, loitering. We call it standing still. They call it loitering. Mm. And here we are having to introduce legislation in three states to defend our right to stand still, to defend a right to sit down.
UC Berkeley came out with a new study looking at this and found that San Francisco and Los Angeles lead the pack with 23 restrictions. In San Francisco, between 2007 and 2013, 3,000 citations every year are handed out for just what you mentioned, sleeping, camping.
And we have the same study being done from the state of Washington, and we have the same study being done in the state of Colorado.
And just to let people know, I got a call from a lawyer last year. Someone in the Tenderloin was arrested
for sitting on a milk crate.
Yeah. So this is what's happening in San Francisco.
Yes, and that's why it's Jim Crow. That's why it's Antioch. That's why it's sundown towns. They've abused this authority. And homeless people are today's target of these laws. But we weren't the first target. And unfortunately, we won't be the last unless these bills pass. Because these bills say if everybody, even the people that write the legislation are going to sit, eat, lay down, sleep. Everyone's going to do it. So no more can local governments pass laws that make it illegal to conduct activities that every single person is going to conduct.
So then the state law would wipe out these city laws?
The state law would say you cannot criminalize these acts, sitting, standing, sleeping in a legally parked vehicle, eating, laying down in a non-obstructive manner. Nobody, not just homeless people, it wouldn't protect just homeless people. It would say that nobody can be criminalized for performing an activity that every single human being is going to perform, whether they like it or not. Your body's going to tell you, sit down, go to sleep, eat something, whether you like it or not. So that activity should never be deemed as an illegal activity.
I had the experience of interviewing a person who was sitting on the sidewalk, and I was kneeling next to her, and a police officer came by and said we had to move, that we could not be sitting and kneeling on the sidewalk. So I had a very personal experience of what it was like to be, quote, moved on.
You heathen. You heathen criminal, you.
So just to summarize the possible solutions,
yes.
I think there are three solutions in addition to what Paul just described. One is increased money for housing using a housing first policy. The second is increased case management. And the third is employment and supported employment so that people have something to do during the day.
Dr. Robert Okun served as chief of psychiatry at SF General for 17 years, and he's author of Silent Voices, People with Mental Disorders on the Street. Paul Bowden is executive director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project, author of House Keys, Not Handcuffs, Homeless Organizing, Art, and Politics in San Francisco. Paul will be speaking next Tuesday, March 10th at 7:30 at the Booksmith, 1644 Haight Street. Paul and Bob, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What do you want from your call? On our next show, we want to hear from you. Every year, we open the lines to get your thoughts on what you like about the show and what we can do better. From climate change to income inequality, how can we best focus on solutions? What shows stand out for you, and what would you add to our editorial mix? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Knock Wynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email